Hi, Jerry. Paul Lovegren up in Louisville, Kentucky. It was real good to be with you folks down in Charleston. Bonnie and I enjoyed it an awful lot. Unfortunately, we didn't hardly see too much of each other except for a few minutes before and after sessions. You know, Jerry, I had told you, and you and I had discussed this talk that I taped of Bill Wilson back in Akron, Ohio at Founders Day, and this was in 1954. And I think it was the 19th anniversary of AA Founders Day. And Bill used to always come up to Akron, or come out to Akron from New York, and talk at Founders Day. And then as of recent years, of course, the practice was discontinued. So we used to go over there quite regularly, and I remember I brought this big old Webcord tape recorder. It must have weighed 60, 70 pounds. And if I recall correctly, although it's hard to remember back that many years, I was the only one that was taping at that session. So it's sort of a rare tape, I would guess. I've given a few copies to some people. You had said that you didn't have a real good tape of Bill giving his own story. I had mentioned to some of the girls from New York when Bonnie and I were at some conferences that I did have this tape, and they were interested in getting it too for your AA library, out of headquarters, that is. So here's the talk by the founder of AA, or co-founder of AA, Bill Wilson, at the 19th anniversary Founders Day meeting in Akron, Ohio. It was in June 1954. And this was even before Bonnie became sober, Jerry. That was 4 years later. But we did have a few periods like this when we did go to places and really enjoy ourselves, the same as a lot of other people have done. Too bad you're not going to be at Shreveport for the tri-state. I got hooked to be the Al-Anon speaker, I guess, and also up at Bluestone. I guess this is in October. I think we'd mentioned or talked about this. And Jerry, I appreciate all the help you've been to Bonnie and I, and all of the swell things you've done for us. So here we go with Bill.
Dear and precious friends, from the four corners of our AA world, I bring the greetings and love of every member of our society. We're gathered here today, as Ethel so well said, in gratitude. In gratitude for our living and loving God, who threw new life in upon our dark world and has permitted so many of us to issue from our caves. We are gathered here to commemorate the striking of a spark that was to light a candle. A candle which at first flickered fitfully, and at times nearly went out, but which was then passed from hand to hand until it has reached nearly every distant shore of the world. I suppose an occasion of this sort would best be served by telling some yarns. Perhaps we would like to think again together about the chain of providential events that led to the striking of the spark over in Henrietta Seiberling's living room 19 years ago. we then might witness together. And many of you indeed can relive the experience when the spark lit the candle. And we can remember together with gratitude and joy the flying blind period of our pioneering time. And when we have dwelled on this at good length, because this is the thing that concerns us most, we might get on the magic carpet, so to speak, and travel worldwide and see how the candle has gone from hand to hand. And then we might presume to lift the veil that obscures our future and wonder what destiny God may have in store for us. Relative to the events that led up to the striking of the spark, I suppose that, humanly speaking, the first man who had anything to do with this society is one who still does not know that he did. He is none other than Carl Jung, the great pioneer of psychiatry at Zurich, Switzerland. And there, probably in the very early 30s, he had treated the drunk for a year. The man had great hope, earnestly wished to get well, thought he had got well, and then, as we so well understood, found himself, in spite of all these resources, drunk again. So he goes back to the doctor and says, "How bad is this, doctor, in my case?" And that very great and humble man, this man of the science of the mind, replied, "Well, Roland, I have never seen one single case of alcoholism. So grave is yours that has ever recovered, excepting through a religious conversion experience. These experiences indeed take on many forms, but they all have the same substance. They enable people to do, as by a gift from somewhere, the things that they could not do before. But these events in the world of the alcoholic are only very occasional. The lightning strikes here, it strikes there. We don't know just why. So our friend Roland began to search for such an experience, and he found it in the Oxford groups then flourishing in the United States, and even more so in Europe. He had a summer place near Bennington, Vermont. He heard of the dilemma of a friend of mine to be brought before a judge, to be committed to an asylum, an old school friend that I hadn't seen in years. He and others of the Oxford group went to my friend and told him of their own release from drinking. You see, here that early, alcoholics were talking to other alcoholics. It so fell out that my old friend never quite made the grade, until very recently, by the way. But the essential ideas were beginning to fall into place. And that friend came to New York City, and hearing of my plight, that a good doctor had said I couldn't live another year, came to see me at 182 Clinton Street, Brooklyn. And across the kitchen table, he presented me what are the essential legacies that we now enjoy in this society. He presented me an opportunity to be sober if I would. He presented me much more. He presented me an opportunity to be whole and to be a growing human concern. He presented me, who had then begun to live on borrowed time, an opportunity to serve for many years, to carry this message to others. So the elements of recovery, unity, and service were all contained in that little conversation across the kitchen table. It is the essence of our inheritance. Well, I won't go into my own experience. Most here know it. How I was released from alcoholism in Towns Hospital in December 1934. How I became possessed of a desire to work with other alcoholics. Worked like the Dickens for 6 months. Nothing happens. People begin to say, well, when is this guy going to quit being a missionary? I try to get into a business deal, finally fall into a rather lame one. It takes me here to Akron, and then the deal falls through. And I'm walking up and down the morning after, a Saturday. My friends are gone. Myself, no car fare home. For the first time since my experience in the 6 months before, I began to be frightened I would get drunk. I looked in the bar down there, and then I walked to the other end of the lobby, and I saw a board on which were the names of churches and preachers. And by now I said, well, I must find another drunk. Not this time to preach to him, not this time to teach him, but because I need his company to keep me sober. Which was a marked step in humility for me. I need another drunk by whom I can stay alive myself. For I had found that in working the 6 months before with a great many alcoholics indeed, that though none of them had dried up, it had a tremendous effect and helpfulness in keeping me so. So now the temptation was upon me. I must lose my life to find it in working with somebody else. So I call up a well-loved preacher in this town, Dr. Thomas. I asked for him today. I said I'd written him a letter to his former church. I wondered if it'd reach him. And the good clergyman who said to me, reach him, he says, all you got to do is to write a letter to Wallertunks, Ohio, and it'll get him. Anyhow, I announced the good man over the phone what my need was, that I needed a drunk to work upon. Well, he was a little astounded at that. I imagine at that time, drunks separately were bad enough, but if you began to collect them together, you could have trouble. But he caught the idea. He referred me to Norman Shepherd, then in the Oxford Group, working at the Firestone Company. Norman gave me a list of people. And I canvassed that list eagerly. But everybody happened to be going somewhere else. They would see me the next day, perhaps. They were cordial. They were nice. Some of them really understood, I think. But nobody could see me then, and it was then that I needed help. And at the very end of that list stood the name of a person who was to be the link between me and Dr. Bob. Who, because on that day, she cared enough and understood enough, we all of us here are alive. And the name was Henrietta Starkey. And I thought it might be some older members of the family. And I couldn't imagine going out to one of the Sarblings on a Saturday afternoon looking for a drunk to work on. It didn't seem to square up. I even went back downstairs and took another look at the bar room, another look at the church directory. Something said, my boy, you'd better make that call. So I made it. and Henrietta's delightful southern voice came on the wire, and instantly she caught my knees and she said, "Won't you come right out here?" So I landed in the gatehouse out there at the Cyberling Estate and met Henrietta, who so many of you know and love. And she took me in there, and we talked a little while. And she said, "I know just the one for you. And that would be Dr. Bob. Oh, that fellow has tried so hard, but somehow he can't seem to do it. I'm sure you could help." She goes immediately to the phone. It's Mother's Day. She calls up over there, and Ann answers. And Henrietta says, "There's a man from New York who says he's an alcoholic, whatever that is, and I think he can help Dr. Bob." And Ann said, "Well, perhaps he can, but not just at the moment, Henrietta, because it is Mother's Day, you know, and Dr. Bob is a sentimental dear, but he has just come in with a potted plant for me, which he has placed on a table, but he is so potted that he is under the table, so I don't think we'll be over." "But," said Henrietta brightly, as one who understood and cared enough, "but Ann, can't you come over tomorrow?" Well, Ann said, "We'll try and bring it." So Henrietta said, "Take dinner with me tomorrow, and we'll see if we can get them over." And I think it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon of that Sunday that Ann and Dr. Bob walked in. Doctor was very restless. He said he couldn't stay only about 5 minutes. And as soon as I got him aside, I said, "I understand, old boy, you're pretty thirsty. I don't want to keep you long," but Henrietta discreetly led us into the library just as you come in the door there. And we shut the door and began to talk. And we kept talking until 11 o'clock at night. And there, I think, something passed between us. And the spark was struck. If you look at Dr. Bob's story in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you will see that he was not very much impressed with my spiritual qualifications. And if that were so, he was quite right about it. I never have made too much headway myself. But he was impressed by the fact that I was an alcoholic who had suffered his agonies, knew every twist and turn of his warped mind, and moreover, even though he was a doctor, I was able to bring him medical knowledge of alcoholism, showing him how it was an obsession, though once a habit, but now an obsession, that condemned him to drink against his will and a physical sensitivity that guaranteed he would go die or go mad if the drinking went on. Such was the age-old dilemma of the drunk. Time out of mind. And Bob understood, and I suppose that struck him at depth. For you see, I had stopped talking then about my spiritual qualifications and my bright light experience and all that kind of business. In fact, old Doc Silkworth says, "My friend, you've got the cart before the horse. You've got to punch it into these drunks that they're fatally ill. And coming from you, it may strike deep enough to soften them up." And if you read Dr. Bob's story, you'll see that is the essence of the impression that I made on him that day. Well, he did sober up and departed from us in 1950. And the prince of all 12 steppers, my most beloved friend, with whom I can say there was never an angry argument or a hard word in all of our association. And that is a tribute to him and not to me, because I've had lots of hard words with lots of people, but never with Dr. Bob. Well, Annie was a prudent person, and you know that prudence rates high in the list of Christian virtues. And she thought to herself, "Well, now if I invite this fellow Bill over to the house, he can kind of keep an eye on Bob. In fact, they might be able to keep an eye on each other." I wanted to carry on this little proxy fracas I was in, a lawsuit that's going. So So I go over to live at the Smith household. Never can I forget those early mornings there, and sitting by the fireplace, our quiet time, reading from the Bible, Corinthians, that greatest of all definition of love, James, who said that faith without works is dead. And suddenly that latter phrase began to burn into Bob's consciousness, because he said, hadn't we better be doing a little 12-step work? So we shopped around at first. There was a preacher down the street. He had one in tow. He's right here today, too. And it wasn't Bill, AA number 3, who is so sick. It was another one, Eddie, and his wife Ruth, and the kids. And Eddie wasn't ready. He was awfully badly derailed, and invited the whole family to come and live there. And how we worked with Eddie. And it was a bust. And along about this time, Dr. Bob said, I've got to go to a convention down in Atlantic City. And Ann made frantic motions to me, no, no, no. And, Bob said, but I've always gone. I couldn't miss one of these, or could I, or should I? Well, I said, after all, you've got to live in a world where a drug is, so why don't you go? This is about maybe 2 weeks after the conversation with Henrietta. So the dear old boy started for the convention. Well, we didn't hear from him for quite a while, for some reason or other. And about 4 o'clock in the morning of the fifth day, he got poured off the train, went over to the house of his nurse, where we, Annie and I, found him. Well, it was a terrible dilemma then. Not only the alcoholic dilemma, but there was a certain surgical dilemma. About 3 days hence, an operation had to be performed by him on somebody, and a serious one. And when he realized the plight that he was in, and that the frightful hangover he had, well, it was something fierce. So we started a round-the-clock tapering operation on the old boy, and the idea, you see, was to edge him up to that operation, not too tight to do it, but not so sober that he couldn't. And on the third night of this process, in which we got him eased down off the perch, Dr. Bannon had put Bob and me in the same room. And he was awake at about 4 o'clock, the morning of the operation, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, Bill, I'm going to go through with this. I said, you mean the operation? Oh, yes, he said, yes, the operation, to be sure. Now, he said, what we've been talking about. Smithy was a man of few words, quite unlike me. So he goes down there, and I remember how Ann and I waited and prayed while he went into that hospital. And we had him just right. Not too tight, just right. And he did it. And he came out of there, and that was June 10th, 1935. The candle was lit from the spark that had been struck. You old-timers know how it flickered as we passed it from hand to hand. You will remember how in 1937 I came out here, and sitting in Dr. Bob's living room, he and I realized for the first time that enough time had elapsed upon enough sufferers on enough cases to prove beyond any doubt that God was sending a new light upon our dark world. How we speculated how we could spread this thing. This had been so painfully so slow. Didn't we need missionaries? Didn't we need literature? Maybe we needed a string of hospitals or drunk tanks, you know, to make the profit to pay the missionaries. I hope to get in on that, too, you know. And we went over to T. Henry Williams that night to the meeting, and there were about 18 there, and we debated these things. And there was the conservative wing, and there was the radical wing in the debate. I'm afraid I was a radical. And the conservative said, well, let's keep it simple. Our Lord had no books, he had no hospital, he had no nothing. On the other hand, I was a promoter, and I said, well, if it doesn't spread any faster than this, it's going to get pretty garbled. It may fail entirely. How are we going to get this message out? And you know how that eventuated in a center down in New York, an office that could answer inquiries as we got publicity. You will remember the story of the pains of the production of the book that was to be Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939, the day on which our candle, now fully lighted, got its name. Meanwhile, though, another great event was taking place in this area. As I've just said, this was a very slow business, mostly failure. How broke we were. The anxieties and the joys, too, of that pioneering day can never perish from the memories of any who participated. People remember, you will remember, came over to T. Henry's from Cleveland. And finally, the candle was transferred over there, as it had previously been to New York, where we were just then coming up with the book, many stories being contributed from here. And a little meeting was started over there in Cleveland, and it had only grown to about 20 in number, when suddenly a gent who really understood drunks by the name of Elmer Davis, published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer in the fall of 1939, a series of pieces, a lot of them. The Plain Dealer liked the idea. God love them, one of our greatest friends. And they put these pieces in a box right plump in the middle of the editorial page. And every other day they would run editorials alongside. And the effect of all this was for the Plain Dealer to say to the good folks of Cleveland and this area about, come and get it, folks. This AA thing is good. Immediately there was a clamor of inquiries such as we have never seen in any local area. A terrific outburst of enthusiasm for AA. The little band of 20 was utterly swamped by perhaps hundreds of inquiries. And in 4 months' time, they had sobered up more people in Cleveland than we had sobered up in the whole 4 years. Well, this frantic process taught us some lessons, as well as to give us the mighty assurance that mass production of sobriety was now possible. We learned that we had to form better relations with hospitals. There had to be more models of the magnificent setup that was just then being inaugurated here at St. Thomas, the first religious institution ever to open its doors to our society. That sublime, indeed divine partnership between Sister Ignatia and Dr. Bob. We had to learn all about that sort of thing, and in Cleveland they had to learn in a hurry. So better arrangements began to be made, and out of it came the idea that each new AA member should have a personal sponsor. Someone who'd see him through, see him along for a time, until he got going. During the rush over there, they didn't take long to make a new sponsor. A fellow would see a guy in a hospital, yank him out of bed, take him to a meeting, take him back to the hospital to see another case and said, now you're an experienced AA. And lo and behold, the great discovery, they went right on getting sober. So then, you see, here in this town, well, it's marked by a plaque up there in St. Thomas, which many of you will see tonight. The spark was struck. The first group was formed. And Dr. Bob, that prince of 12 steppers, with immense struggle and fortitude, gave birth to the first AA group of Alcoholics Anonymous. At the New York end, we were concerned with the spread of this thing worldwide, and chores and tasks like literature and that sort of thing. And then, as you see at Cleveland, they proved that we could mass-produce sobriety. Then in 1941, these pioneer groups were really assailed by a problem in mass sobriety, because Jack Alexander, God love him, and the publishers of the Post, printed as the feature issue of their March number of that year a piece about our fledgling society that, believe me, was a Lollapalooza. It was so effective that if you think the Cleveland rush was a big rush, you should have seen the mail that descended on that little New York post office box. 6,000 inquiries, frantic ones, in maybe 6 weeks. We were swamped. What would we do? Frantic inquiries. Where do we find this thing? How do we learn about this? My husband, sometimes the drunks themselves, in their agony, wrote too. Well, we had old-timers in the existing groups who were traveling on the road. We sent some of these inquiries to them, knowing them by cities. Others we patiently wrote to, hundreds, thousands of letters. We sent them a pamphlet. People returned to buy the book. And then started this phenomenal spread, which not only demonstrated that mass sobriety was possible in an area, all of a sudden, but it proved that we could spread fast. And soon, the length and breadth of the land, little twos and threes and fours and fives of us were gathered. And presently, at Little Rock, Arkansas, we actually started the first group by mail from the New York office, an event of profound significance. And presently, this thing was traveling on to Hawaii, to Australia, until now it has reached 52 countries. And only a few months ago, I saw a translation of the 12 steps into Japanese. The Buddhists, too, say that AA is good. So went the inevitable march of this thing. But I'm telling you that during this hectic period, triggered by the Cleveland thing and exploded by the Saturday Post piece, there was nothing that looked very inevitable about it to us. Because here were all these groups growing. And did we have growing? Oh, my, the problem. How are we to function? Could we always keep it in the homes? Would we have to move it into halls? What about these erratic characters that are coming in? The originators thought they were pure alcoholics, nothing else the matter, you know. What about these strange birds? What about these disruptors? What about the little red riding hoods and the big bad wolves? Should we have clubhouses or not have? Should we play cards or not play cards? All the problems were legion. And they descended upon all of these little inexperienced groups like an avalanche. And from New York, we had to retail the information from the old pioneering groups of New York, Akron, and Cleveland back to them and keep track of all these travelers on the road. And then Alkies began to run to the microphones and the newspapers and get the pictures printed. And we say, gee whiz, if they fell on their faces and got drunk, what about this anonymity at the public level? So there was this great and exciting welder. A fearsome and yet joyous experience. And you know the adolescence of anything or anyone is a fearsome but a joyous time. And so is ours. And it was during that period that the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous came to view. That group of 12 principles, which later on in 1953 assembled an international convention at Cleveland, we decided to take our stand as a society. And as early as 1945 or 6, not at all as author of the traditions, merely the hand that held the pencil, reflecting your experience, we were able to say, the whole is greater than the part. The good of this society is greater than the interest of any individual. And I ask myself, what, greater than mine? We were able to say then, although I sometimes wondered privately if it were true, that the only authority in Alcoholics Anonymous shall be God as he may speak through the group conscience. Our leaders are to be trusted servants. They shall not govern. And privately I said to myself, what? I'm not inspired like all these drunks collectively? I'm not to govern? Well, guess not. They won't let me. During this period, we had terrible times with membership. As I said, we were rather afraid of impure alcoholics. That is, the respectable ones were. So we had rules and rules and rules to keep people out of AA who might, dump us back in the drink. Why they had so many rules one time, I wrote a letter to all the groups and I sent in a list of all these rules and regulations about members. Boy, little Ruthie and I looked over these letters and we put all one of these rules on a sheet of paper and we kept pasting it on while it looked like a newspaper ticker tape. And if all the rules that all the groups had were in force everywhere all at once, nobody could have possibly got into AA. Well, then we lost our fear. And we found that the strangest people became our friends. And that this thing was able to transcend with ease every barrier of race, of creed. And all strange people showed up. Criminals, think of it, in prison. Us respectable ones like to forget that practically any of us could have been in jail had we been caught. But no, Alcoholics Anonymous in prisons, what were people thinking? Well, the respectable socialite alcoholic, would he come into a society where there were criminals? Oh, no, we mustn't have such people around. The answer to that was 200 AA groups in federal pens and state prisons. The parole rate exactly reversed. 80% of them used to go back for drinking, now only 20. When the women showed up, oh boy, what a sensation that was. This will surely disrupt the society. And now, God love them, we couldn't get along without them. You know, on these distant beachheads, they reenact these fearsome times still. For in 1950, Lois and I landed on an airfield at Oslo, Norway. AA had got there ahead of us. There were 1,000 members in Norway. The meetings were all closed. They were so anonymous that they used their first names in speaking to each other. An American girl who was the wife of an attaché to the American embassy and a marvelous member couldn't even get into one of these Norwegian secret society. Because she was a woman, she might disrupt it. And then all this time, our wives patiently plodded along, and we forced them to do it. We'd come back to these dear people who had seen us through, and we'd say, Mama, get a load of this, them 12 steps. and she who had done the best she could would wonder. The next thing she'd find would be that we were out nights more than we were when we were drunk. And poor Mama began to feel like a hen who had hatched out a duck egg. And the duck, it was just swimming out and and was gone around the point and might be home for supper and might not. And besides, there were female ducks out there, too. So we had our problems, all right. We had our problems. And the outgrowth of this fresh suffering on the part of our wives, who felt that they couldn't quite belong, has recently eventuated in those wonderful family groups, whose numbers have jumped in 4 years from 50 to over 700 groups, doing prodigies for our home relations, our wives, our friends, asking not what ails the drunk, but what did this drinking do to us? What ails us? Oh, one could go on for hours, recounting fresh aspects of this mirror. I look out from my window in my study at Bedford Hills over the horizon and realize in awe that I cannot grasp even the smallest fraction of what is going on or about to be. Now you see this simple legacy that my friend brought me over the kitchen table, the chance to be sober from alcohol, the chance to be whole and in one piece and a going concern, the chance to be emotionally sober, and the chance to serve and to function. Well, those legacies became group possessions as well as individual possessions. So that our society as a whole is concerned with the principles upon which all of us and those to come shall recover our 12 steps. It is concerned with our tradition, which we hope will hold us in unity for so long as God shall need us. And it is concerned with the third legacy, which has to do with all of those things that make the 12 step possible. Whether it is the wife pouring a cup of coffee in the living room, whether it is a landlord providing a hall, whether it is a foundation with trustees providing services and magazines and literature, whether it is you and I putting some gas in the tank of the automobile, that is a part of the legacy of service, which includes the 12 steps as its heart. But it also includes everything, every legitimate and proper activity that makes the carrying of the message possible. Our third legacy. Now then, it is an odd thing, or is it so odd, that right here in Akron, where the spark was struck and the candle was first lit, they were only recently seen that it is necessary for this area to function as a whole. Long since, many years since, other cities have had a place where AA could be reached on the telephone, from which public relations could be handled, where people could be interviewed, where hospital connections could be made. These are common places in nearly every city. Why haven't we had them here in Akron? Well, because the older folks around here said, let's keep it simple. And why were they able to say that all these years? Let's keep it simple. Let's not have any area committee. Let's not have any office. I think they were quite right in their contention, let's keep it simple. I'm for keeping it simple. But the reason that they were able to say this all those years was because two people in this town were keeping it simple for them. There was Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatia. And between them, they were receiving the inquiries. They were indoctrinating those alcoholics. They were seeing that they got medically treated. And that flashes. Pair. Were your intergroup association. So when they were gone, there was a vacuum, wasn't there? Just as we found there was in other places. So I'm awful glad to see that sometimes the first shall be last, and sometimes the last shall be first. And so marches on this AA. Has this movement got its sins? Do I mean to make a talk which is only in praise of ourselves and commemoration of the wonderful things that we have done? No, really. No, the real story of AA is the story of God working through very erratic people. People who, even sober, are still very sick. I myself have been one of the sickest of these. Over the years, my gift of sobriety, I managed to cling on to. But over the years, there have been times when sobriety has been my only virtue. How God has contrived to work through such fallible ones as I have been, as you have been, well, that is the real story of Alcoholics Anonymous. How God, through very fallible people, has apparently brought into being a very great and perfect thing. God's work. We the instruments only. How well we know that when we think about it. Yes, I think that God has been constructing a cathedral of the Spirit. And on its great floor, where are inscribed our 12 steps of recovery, there now stand 150,000 of us in security and upon a solid footing. That floor is of infinite width and width and length, and reaches worldwide. And lots sitting here have seen the side walls to our Cathedral of the Spirit rise, and have seen them successively buttressed by our 12 traditions, which we hope will contain this society in unity for so long as God shall need it. And then we have seen in recent years the final perfection of the spire of this cathedral, whose name is Service, and on whose summit is a beacon, a candle, once lit on this city on the hill, Akron, a candle shining all over the world. And may it too continue to burn, undimmed and pure, for so long as God will.
Jerry, following is a talk that you might be interested in listening to. This is one of the final talks that I heard Bill make. It was in April 1968 at the 8th Al-Anon World Service Conference in New York City. This was at the George Washington Hotel. And it was sort of prophetic, or whatever you want to call it. As I recall, I just talked to Bill a few times at board meetings after that. And then he made a brief appearance at the WSC conference in 69, and then 70 he wasn't there, as I recall. Well, no, the 70, of course, is when things started happening. You know what I mean. But I think that you might like to hear how Bill sounded in the last talk that I ever heard him give.
When he didn't have a powerful message for all of us, and now I would love to present Bill.
We've got things adjusted. Where shall I begin? Well, I could begin, as I always do, by saying, with increasing certainty each year, that the advent of the Al-Anon Society is the biggest thing that's happened since AA began. And were I to continue my old familiar talk, I would dwell on the suffering that our alcoholism has inflicted on you, dear people, and remind you that for each of us who groans with the sufferings of alcoholism, even since he dried up, that for every one of us, and there are 5 or 10 of you. Nor need I dwell on the character of the sufferings and the deformities that we have inflicted upon you. It would be presumptuous for me to do this because you know better than we drunks do. So I thought we'd try for a change of stance or pace tonight and try to think together about the significance of world service to AA and, of course, to you today and for tomorrow. I'm most happily aware that a great many of the acute and fearsome problems that we encountered as a fledgling society have not been yours, because with great skill you have adapted our experience as expressed in the steps and the traditions and more lately the concepts for world service. There has been a perfectly marvelous and compared with us a very rapid adaptation. Actually, I think that AA has reached the end of an epoch, and you are nearing this end. The time when, let us say, that we are satisfied that the basics of the 12 steps will be practiced into the indefinite future, and that the traditions bearing so much upon our unity and upon our action, these things are clear. Only last year, a last structural refinement
was placed in our society, the assumption of full responsibility by the AAs on the Board of Trustees. So therefore, we might conclude that from here on, everything is just going to be ducky. Well, I don't think so. We are living in a world of untold peril. We are in a world where man is set against man, group against group, nation against nation, as never before in history, and with instruments of destruction that defy the imagination. It is a very dangerous world, and in our happiness and in our newfound unity and in our peaceful pursuit of the general welfare, it is easy for us to forget this. But is it not true that as we look out upon the world, its divisions are no different in kind than those which shattered us, first as alcoholics and then as families, to the point of virtual extinction? This was our A-bomb, which did not quite go off. So then, let us remember that these forces are not only around us. They are still in us. They are late. AA and Al-Anon represent, in a very real sense, as do the great religions of the world, an aspiration on the part of mankind to make constructive use of his instincts, whether they be for sex, for possessions, for prestige. These instincts were God-given if they are constructively used. And our program tries to channel instincts gone mad and rampant into the channels of growth in the likeness and image of the Father of Lights who presides over us all. This, as we know, is a halting path, punctuated by adversities, and we have faced, and will always face the crucial question, are these adversities obviously permitted by the Creator? Are these adversities going to be converted into destruction or into a propellant toward greater things? We are driven into AA by sheer, stark, and utter calamity. And then we come to a point where we say, but how wonderful this is. I don't like all these damn principles exactly, but they look right to me. So maybe I will conform, not because I wholly wish to, but because they seem good and right. And now and then we reach a plateau where, for the moment, we stand on the mountaintop And there we conform because this is what we deeply and really want. And then the old forces take over and we slide it back down away and get back to the ought to. And then we come back to the terrible imperative, the must, because if we fail on the lower rung, then it is death or madness by alcoholism, an end into which we take into a living death those about us. Now then, the tradition of AA, and when I say AA, I mean Al-Anon too throughout this talk, is not a catalog of the virtues of our two societies. In thoughtless moments, we are apt to forget that all these things are in the nature of gifts. We forget, and so we say, well, with us AAs, the common welfare comes first. We say, in Al-Anon and AA, we have democracy in the purest town meeting style. In AA, we have no membership rules. Whilst other societies forge rules, inflict punishments for their infraction. Forgetting, of course, that the demon Barleycorn is at the elbow always, awaiting to inflict the ultimate punishment for nonconformity. And yes, we go on. And we say, well, of course, we do so well in AA and Al-Anon with our specialty that we really have time for these efforts in the world around us. Besides, we're about the best thing that's come along, and we don't want to be troubled with the complications of endorsements and alliances and all of this sort of thing. And then we say, well, of course, this is a very spiritual outfit, this Al-Anon, this AA. And of course, we have observed that even religious institutions possessing great amounts of real estate are likely to be somewhat contaminated. So we aren't going to have any real estate. And we're going to have the least possible property, a la St. Francis of Assisi. So we go along in this fashion to catalog our virtues. These, dear friends, are not our virtues. They are the gifts that have come out of the awful imperative of adversity. They are a code, really, of accepted do's and don'ts, the failure of which can lead to disunity, and from there it is but a step to the brink of disaster. So in AA and in Al-Anon, we have all these gifts. In some respects, we are a unique island, a sort of a paradise in a sense, really. Something we scarcely deserve. We know not really why we have it, but within God's mind. But here it is. Now then, so much for the day. We can say that the edifice of the spirit in its main outlines is complete. that it is like unto a cathedral on the great floor of which we stand secure. And the side walls are there. And we think that they may not fail us because they are buttressed by the traditions. And now the spire is clearly to be seen in the form of service. At its apex, world service, a beacon which beckons all those who suffer alcoholism and in Al-Anon its malign consequence. Well, this is an unbelievable, unparalleled state of affairs, set in a surrounding of immense potential destruction. Now then, I am not pointing to that destruction as though it ought to be the occasion of our fear, but clearly enough, it should be the occasion for our prudence and our vigilance. Not so much the fear of these powers going astray in the world around us, as fears that the germs of these things are still in us and can rend our society. Now, one of the great unifying forces in AA, in addition to the 12 steps and the spirit of the 12 steps as manifested in the tradition, one of the greatest forces for growth and unity in our experience in AA and in more latter years in the experience of Al-Anon has been the world service idea. Right at this juncture, people may inquire, but why don't our societies have some sort of government? Is there nobody in authority who can issue commands? Is there no one who can inflict even mild penalties? Is there no one who has the authority to collect money? No. We who are the trusted servants of the conscience of our two societies are not endowed with any of those attributes, not because we are so superior to the people around us, because we have Barleycorn who says, you are going to reasonably conform or I will kill you. And then we have the love of God and of man which draws us on. Ah, we're ever so fortunate. But let's not credit ourselves with this. So, it may be that as time passes, the problems that once generated these traditions will recur. To a degree, they will recur with each succeeding generation of Al-Anons and AAs. They are bound to. In fact, I hope they do, up to a point. There has never been great anything but good outcome in the long run, and sometimes it's been the mighty long run, in dissension with an AA. Up to a point, It is the creator of adversity out of which we may grow as individuals, as groups, and as societies. But when that begins to be expressed in real schism and what looks like permanent division, when our internal controversies begin to be apparent in the world around us and keep people from looking at the beacon on the spire, then we begin to be in trouble. So vigilance about these. In AA, and I'm sure in Al-Anon, the advice is rightly and oft given. Live in today. Tomorrow is gone. Yesterday is gone. Tomorrow is not here. This is great advice. Because, obviously, the fellow who is still trying to live in the past is either living there with his guilt or the memory of superficially joyous days that he would like to reenact. He is so preoccupied with this thing that he stultifies his own growth and is a drag on people about. In the best sense of the word, he is an ultra-conservative. He fights change. He lives in the past. Then we have the people who are overliving in the now, you might say. The main chance in the next hour. So they flutter from this to that to the other thing. Being so preoccupied by the now that they cannot abstract the lessons from the experience of the past and drag it into the now for you. And this is the function of the tradition. Neither are they able to think about the future, either because they are afraid. So they dwell in the present, and not necessarily with any great or successful growth. Then we have these people who are the dreamers. We'll always need a certain number. But obviously one cannot emotionally live in the future because the realities of today, he can't operate in the framework of now. Now these are the liabilities that we come to when we divide time into past, present, and future. But look at time in another way. Is it not with us humans a stream of consciousness on which we are borne along from the past into the present and into tomorrow? And therefore, I think we must more consciously, while always refusing to live emotionally in the past or emotionally in the future, we should be ready to get a sense of history as to the experience of yesterday so as to keep those traditions infused with the power to guide and protect us today. And should we not give thought for tomorrow, not in any fearful sense, but in a sense of prudence and responsibility, where are we going as individuals, as society? Toward better things? Are we settling for complacency? Are we crying for space flight? What are we doing? Is it sound? Will it spell progress for tomorrow? Well, in the happy state in which we find ourselves in this year of our Lord, 1968, all this happiness, all of this wonder, all of these miracles can bring us complacency. But let me pose what some of the problems of the future might be. Religious schism? No. Probably never. The ecumenical spirit of the world, in its solidly uniting front, crossing all religions, does away with the possibility that might have arisen even 100 years ago here and elsewhere. No. No. But in the world today, have you ever thought what would happen if AA had to go underground? If our people occasionally face firing squads? You know, I say this not in fear, but just in prudence. Let us remember our blessings. Let us take right thought for the lessons of yesterday, that they may bear upon today and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, for so many of them as God would let us have. Good night. God bless you. Thank you.